Welcome to the Layer 8 Podcast, Season 2. This season, we'll again hear from the experts. These experts are social engineers and open source intelligence investigators. Sometimes, they'll tell us stories about their experiences, and sometimes, we'll have some questions for them. We hope you'll enjoy them.
Welcome to another episode of the Layer 8 Podcast. We have a very special guest for you. I'm honored to be joined today by a man who is a 29-year veteran of federal service, including the United States Naval Academy and the U.S. Marine Corps. He was the head of the FBI's Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, where he stopped the efforts of American adversaries and worked to recruit spies for America. He is an accomplished author, having written the books It's Not About Me, Top 10 Techniques for Building Quick Rapport with Anyone, Sizing People Up, a veteran FBI agent's user manual for behavioral prediction, and The Code of Trust, an American counterintelligence expert's 5 rules to lead and succeed, with the latter two being co-authored with Cameron Stoff. He's an educator at the annual Human Hacker Conference. He owns and runs the website peopleformula.com, and he is a board member with the Innocent Lives Foundation. Welcome, Robin Dreich.
Thanks for having me. That makes it sound like I'm a busy guy, but I'm not.
It certainly seems like you're a busy guy. So that's an awful lot that you do. So thank you so much for joining us.
I'm really happy to be here, especially with the ILF jersey in the background. Makes for a great kickoff to anything. Probably one of the greatest things I've been part of. So
first, I have a bone to pick with you.
Okay.
I recently got into audiobooks, and I would listen while walking the dog or exercising. I'd usually choose some lighter reading for those, and I added yours to the list. I think I got maybe 10 minutes into them when I realized I'd made a mistake. These are not books that I could just listen to. I needed to purchase a hard copy because these are manuals. And I mean, they're manuals in that I wanted to take notes. Yeah, I bought your books twice. These were pretty amazing. I mentioned the names in the introduction, but if anybody wants to find them, they're in the description of this episode or at Robin's website, peopleformula.com. So yeah, all of these books that I've been reading have just been amazing. They're incredible manuals. I would imagine that the people listening to this who are greatly into social engineering will get a lot out of It's Not All About Me, the top 10 techniques for building quick rapport with anyone. Do you want to talk briefly about what that book is about?
My first one. So the first one, it's literally just 10 techniques to quick rapport. That came about, many people know the story, but in case you don't, how long ago was that? So I met Chris Hagnagy, I think it was back in 2008, social engineer extraordinaire, CEO of ILF as well. And I met him through a good friend of mine, Joe Navarro, wrote the book, What Everybody Is Saying. Matter of fact, his recent book, Be Exceptional, just came out. Joe's a nonverbal expert and was one of the founders of my behavioral analysis program that I eventually led in the FBI. And Joe had just been on a podcast of Chris's and said, hey, you know, if you want to have another guy on, my friend Robin would be great on your podcast. You know, he does similar things. So I chatted with Chris on his first on that first podcast and discovered I was a social engineer. And I didn't know that because I guess recruiting spies is social engineering. And a couple months later, after the first one, and Chris and I formed a relationship and we started strategizing, putting together his first SECOM class, you know, the social engineering class. He had a last minute cancellation for a podcast and said, hey, Robin, can you do me a favor? Can you come on last minute? I said, yeah, sure, no problem. What do you want me to talk about? And he goes, I don't know. How do you develop rapport in 5 minutes? And so literally I wrote down, you know, the 10 things I do to build rapport. I had never thought of it in terms of that in the past that way. And at the same time, matter of fact, this is really funny. This is the original card I have right here. And on this card, I used to carry it in my wallet, are the impetus of those 10 things. And at the same time, my friend Joe Navarro, who is a avid publisher, numerous books, said, publish, 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 publish. And so that therein lies, I looked at those 10 techniques that I'd made into an article and said, you know, I'm going to make this into a book. And so I labored on my own to do my first self-published book. It's a quick read. It's 25,000 words, 99 pages. I actually do have audio. I might make an audio book out of it because I did read it aloud a few times. It's just effort. And so, yeah, that's how the first one came about. And that was back, I started in 2010. I think I got it out in 2011. And it is literally a fun cult classic. I think I've sold over 100,000 copies of that book as a self-published thing, which led then to publishers coming to me for other ones and stuff. So there you go.
Yeah, it's definitely a great book, and I was really happy when I heard you and Chris talking about it, and I made sure that I picked it up right away to learn from it. And one of the things that I did in anticipation of talking with you is I asked other people for questions for you. So I have some questions from other people based on some of these things as well. I know in Sizing People Up, you also were the 15-minute man where you were brought in to teach people on how to get rapport extremely quickly, doing cold calling within 15 minutes. But sometimes social engineers have even less time than that. What types of quick tips do you like to give social engineers or cold callers to gain as much rapport as they can very quickly?
Well, if you go to DEF CON and watch some of these people get in the booth, that I would just go with them. They're fantastic at doing it. The things I see really work well are when you honor my four pillars that I call them, the four pillars of building really rapid connections, and that is seeking their thoughts and opinions, talking in terms of their priorities, validating them, and giving them choices. And that last one, giving them choices, is really critical because, you know, Robert Cialdini writes in Influence that, you know, you have to answer a couple of questions on a first contact: who you are, what you want, and when you're leaving. And you got to give people a sense of power and control. And so anytime you can state those things rapidly up front, that works amazingly well. I used to do a lot of cold calling with the FBI where I'd knock on the front door of a lot of businesses saying, I'm FBI, I'm here to help. And I would typically, you know, knock on the front door of a business and say, hey, sorry to bother you. My name's Robin. I am a counterintelligence guy with the FBI. You know, we work with a lot of local companies to help protect them against multiple vectors from nefarious actors. If you got like 30 seconds, I can kind of share with you what I can do for you. If not, I completely understand. If you prefer, I come back another time. Or if you think you got everything covered, let me know that too, and I can leave you completely alone. Inevitably, I never had anyone tell me go away. They might have rescheduled from time to time. But again, I answered who I am, what I was there to do in terms of one of their priorities, potential priorities, and I empowered them with choice about how to move forward. So it's just kind of hit those key things right up front. No subterfuge, no deception, although I know you're going to use that in the world of social engineering, you know, for the intent of eventually, you know, providing training and expertise in certain areas. But that's what I'm doing.
And how does talking with somebody over the phone versus in person impact building rapport with the target? Do you significantly change your tactics over the phone due to the lack of micro expression, visibility, reading, displaying?
So my language is going to be the same. I'm going to use pretty much the same things. The power of being able to do things in person is you'll have a little bit easier time to observe their nonverbals and seeing if you're creating any comfort or stress when you're interacting. It'll give you a little bit easier time to match the tempo they have because you can kind of tell someone's tempo through that. You can also kind of tell also if someone tends to be more people-oriented or task-oriented. And so if I know someone's more task-oriented, I'm going to be kind of more bulleted and kind of cut to the chase, as opposed to if I notice someone's a little more people-oriented with their body positioning, use of hands and things like that, I'll be able to use more anecdote and story. So I can adjust myself a little bit easier and read whether I'm having a better impact if you're in person. And Zoom is not too bad with it as well.
Yeah, I can let you know that I am a indirect people-oriented person, and those who have read your book will probably know what that means.
You're a steady relator. You're one of life's beautiful people.
What would help us control unconscious indicators that we're full of crap when doing social engineering work? Like when we are doing our social engineering and they're setting off alarms in our target's head, what are some kind of ways that we might be able to avoid some of those things to avoid being called out?
If you're setting off alarms in someone else and you're noticing them,
yes,
I go with full transparency. Now, you're not going to be transparent, hey, I'm here to do a social engineering thing for you, but you can be transparent over the fact that you recognize that you're causing discomfort and distress in some area. And I call it out and say, oh, it looks like I'm really kind of setting off some bells for you. What kind of things can I do to help alleviate that in you? Because again, what you're doing is you're saying, here's who I am. It looks like you're uncomfortable with me. I understand. What can I do to make you more comfortable? Maybe coming back later is a better time or not, because once you start setting off alarm bells, they're not going to stop unless they are willing to have them stop. And the only way you can have them stop is if they feel comfortable that in In other words, you're being transparent enough in areas that they're thinking you're not being transparent in order to make them feel comfortable. Because that's where, so basically, you're causing distrust by a lack of transparency, making them insecure in areas. So you have to make them feel secure in those areas that they feel insecure in.
That makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that I also liked about the progression of your books is it appears to me that it's a bit of a, I guess, a Venn diagram of rapport and trust, where you started off with it's not all about me teaching rapport, and then you later talk about trust, especially in the Code of Trust. But what do you see as the difference between rapport and trust? And should social engineers who are trying to access a facility or speak to someone on the phone care about trust?
Yeah, so for me, my books are basically my life's journey. It's where I'm at the time and the things I've learned at that point in time. And so, yeah, rapport comes first. It's the baseline in which you establish that first 30 seconds and a couple minutes by doing those things. And it's rapport is the transactional part of engaging another human being, which social engineers do. And a lot of times, social engineers are only doing transactional with certain individuals, get through doors and things like that. But if you move on to and you focus on trying to go beyond transactional with everyone by employing the code of trust, that's going to beget a lot more trust than you might, a lot more access and connection. Because basically, everything you're trying to do is build connection. And trust is great, but the whole point of everything is build a strong enough connection so people will feel comfortable and inspired to be a resource for you in any area you want to move, maneuver in. And that happens through connection. And so, yeah, it is a progression, but with the ultimate goal being a connection. And in order to have a connection, the other person has to feel that it's much more than just transactional in order to have that connection.
And in the Code of Trust, you mention your five basic principles: suspend the ego, be non-judgmental, validate others, honor reason, and be generous. And one of the things that I really liked about the first one, to suspend your ego, is that you mentioned that people have said that they fear getting walked all over like a carpet if they suspend their ego. And you mentioned that that's not really something to be concerned about. Can you talk a little bit more about why they shouldn't be concerned about getting walked all over?
Yeah, because suspending your ego just means that you're focusing on the other person more than you're focusing on yourself. It means you're paying attention and you're, you know, Joe just talked in his recent book, Be Exceptional, about aware. It makes you observant of the other person at a much deeper level because when you actually have more information about the other person by suspending your ego, getting rid of the anecdotal story you're trying to share and pay attention to theirs, so you understand their context, which is empathy, and then you can take action on that context if you want, which is which really elevates that connection. You know, it's making sure that you're just paying attention to all the information and priorities and challenges the other person is providing you. Because ultimately, to me, it's everything comes down to leadership. And leaders are resources for other people without expectation reciprocity. Leaders accomplish goals, missions, and priorities. And leaders create a psychologically safe environment for people to innovate in and work within so they can bring their best out. But all those things happen because you have a destination you know you're walking towards and things you're trying to achieve. And one of the other things you mentioned there is honoring reason. When you have a goal and objective in mind and you're honoring reason, in other words, you're taking actions in terms of those things while making it about everyone else because you have ego suspension, there's nothing to be walked on because it's just because it's not about me doesn't mean I'm being a carpet to be walked on and taken advantage of. Because when I'm honoring reason, part of honoring reason for me is thinking to myself as one of my ends goals, my anchors for everything is creating a good, healthy, strong relationship. Working term there being healthy. If someone's trying to take advantage of me and it's, you know, in an unbalanced and unhealthy way, well, that's not a healthy relationship and I can make new choices.
One of the other things that I read in Code of Trust that I also liked was you were talking about how to ensure that what your goals are align with other goals, and that's going to help to achieve the greater goal. And one example that I remember in Code of Trust was where you described Lila and some of the issues that she was having. And I remember that you were asking her, what are her goals and what are her manager's goals? What do you say if you can't find a place where your goals overlap with management? Like maybe management's goals is simply for them to get a bigger bonus, or in the military, that person just wants for themselves to get a promotion. How do you handle those types of situations?
You have to understand the why. You know, that's the most important. Matter of fact, the group I just worked with had a very similar question. And you have to be able to tie the actions you want to take to their why. In other words, why do they have the priorities they have? So, you know, if they're looking to get a promotion, your job is to be able to figure out how your actions is going to help them get a promotion. And if you can't, don't bother. Don't waste your time. Because if you press an issue of what you want to do and it's not in line with their priorities and you can't explain the why about why it's in line with their priorities, you're going to build a wedge, you're going to build up walls, and they're not going to trust you because they think you're some rogue off on your own mission trying to take care of your own priorities. And that's not ego suspension. That's all about you. So it's really understanding the why of your behavior, having your people around you understand that why, how their actions are impacting, you know, the bottom line of what people are trying to accomplish, including your bosses. Because if it's a guarantee, I get asked this a lot. So, Robin, I'm trying to just get this done. You know, this is the mission. We have to get this done. But my boss is micromanaging me, not trusting me, a roadblock at every corner. What can I do? What's he doing wrong? I said, he's not doing anything wrong. What you're doing, you got to own it. Got to own it all. You don't have to agree with their goals, missions, and priorities, but that's what they are. The reason why they don't trust you, why should they? Why should they let you do things? Because here's a guarantee. If you were actually taking actions that were in terms of their best interest and what they understand the mission to be, they'd let you do it. Why wouldn't they? You haven't taken the time to figure that out. It's on you. What are you going to do to figure that out? That's a conversation you need to have with your boss and say, I understand I have been frustrating to you. I haven't been doing a good enough job taking care of what your bottom line is because I just don't understand what that is, obviously. Help me understand your priorities better and what I can do to service your goals, missions, and priorities. That takes humility. That takes having to have a conversation with someone you might not like. But you know what? Do you want to get along or do you want to quit? I mean, it really comes down to that. And that's where honor and reason is. That's just predictable behavior. If you don't change the way you're doing things in terms of them, they're going to keep treating you the same way. And if you're comfortable with them doing things the way they are, just keep doing it the same way. It won't change. That's the definition of crazy, right? Do the same thing numerous times, expect a different result. Yep.
And along those same lines, I think I saw a common theme in your book where you were talking with people about how they could figure those things out. And it seemed as though each time it was with somebody that was relatively new. I think there was even a time early on where you were speaking to your own Jedi Master Jesse and might have had this issue as well, where you asked Lila, you asked Youngblood, like, what are your goals here? And they came up with some answers and you were like, no, not really. And you got them to dig down further to find out what the real goals were. What advice would you give to somebody to be able to dig down further and realize what are the actual goals, not the superficial goals, when they can't sit and have this conversation with Robin Dreek about the situation?
Just keep asking yourself what the purpose of you achieving these milestones. I call them the means goals and the ends goals. And the means goals are those shorter term, a lot of times more tangible things in your life that you're trying to achieve to get to the end. And those are things, you know, so like in the FBI, it was conduct interviews, conduct investigations, go to training, you know, do surveillances, you know, talk to sources. All those things are the means goals to the end. And the end goal is actually protect national security, which is much more broader. So if you're trying to, this came about, I actually literally discovered this on a case I was working. And it was a recruitment case of a Chinese intelligence officer. And we're talking to the case agent, we're strategizing the recruitment op. And the first step in the code of trust, you know, the actual five-step process I have is what's your goals, your means goals, and your ends goals. And when I asked the case agent, well, what's your goal? And he goes, well, I want to recruit this person. I was like, okay, why? And they would protect national security. Great. Then I reversed it. What's this other person's goal? What are their priorities? And he goes, money. I go, no, that's just a means goal. What are they? Why money? Well, they want to, you know, she likes buying expensive clothes and she likes going to the gym. I said, okay, so why? Well, she's trying to get a promotion at work. All right. Why? Well, because she wants a raise. Why? Well, because she's trying to buy a new house. Ah, I said, so why? Well, because she's trying to get her kids into college in the United States. Ah, I says, now we're getting to the end goals. She's trying to provide psychological comfort from her perspective. And these are the things, the means goals, to get to the end goal of that. So remember, there's lots of means goals. There's lots of ways in order to provide psychological comfort. So once you understand and lock into the end goal someone is trying to achieve, understand and be flexible about how to achieve it, because that flexibility and all those options you're going to have for all these different means goals are going to come from relationships. Relationships bring you the answer to everything. That's why the number one end goal I have with every interaction is to create a good, healthy, strong relationship. You do that by having, number two, open, honest communication with transparency. And three, you make yourself an available resource for the success of others without expectation or reciprocity. You honor those three ends goals, and then whatever mission statement you have as an organization, team, or company, that's the other company ends goal. Everything else is superfluous to that, because all those things get you to that point. So always remember those things, you honor those first, means goals fall into place.
That all seems like great advice. Moving on to the second principle in the Code of Trust, being non-judgmental. One of the things as I was reading your book that I started wondering about is with removing bias. And when you were training FBI agents, I'm guessing this might have come up, but how do you train people to get past unconscious bias? Like if you loathe the person that you're talking to, that's probably going to seep out and the person is going to sense that. What advice would you have for dealing with that and how to avoid that type of thing?
Yeah, I guarantee it will. Matter of fact, I worked with a great American patriot, great investigator, but he had a lot of very, very strong religious convictions in certain areas. And if he knew the other person he was interviewing didn't agree with his convictions, it seeped out nonverbally when he was talking to him. And he was very challenged sometimes because of that, whether by choice or not. The only thing is overcoming your judging of other people is very difficult. I am originally from the Northeast. I grew up in New York, you know, north of the city. I'm an extrovert and very opinionated. So I always use myself as an example. If I can do it, any human being can do it, where you overcome that. And that is, you just have to start getting curious. You know, let go of, you know, your paradigm on what you think normal is. And as soon as something or someone deviates from your baseline, that's when excitement should seep in. So instead of putting up your walls and judging, get curious about how this person came to be this amazing person that you're standing before you today. Non-judgmental curiosity is single-handedly the best thing you can do to get walls down, especially if someone knows that you're different from them. They're expecting you to judge them. They're expecting walls. They're expecting you to be, you know, just negative towards them in some way. Blow their mind and be curious. Because nothing gets walls down more than that. I have made some of the best connections, best friends, and revelations about human beings from all different cultures and backgrounds and demographics just by seeking to understand non-judgmentally. Doesn't mean you change your behaviors or your beliefs necessarily, but when you seek to understand that deeper level, you can now start connecting with everyone. Because as I explained to the agents when I'm training them, you don't have to do any of these things. I can just guarantee what will happen if you don't. You know, if your job is to interview everyone, you know, like in the FBI, in the world of counterintelligence, if a conflict breaks out anywhere in the world, our job is to interview everyone from that country here in the United States to try to create friends, contacts, information to protect warfighters on the ground, to help inform policymakers and help protect national security of the U.S. and our allies. And so if your job is to talk to everyone and build relationships with everyone, and you're told, you know, you don't get to make a choice as who, I can guarantee you're going to fail if you go into that conversation with some preconceived notion of what you think right or wrong is, or they are, or their ethics, their morals. Just be curious. I don't allow people to bother me. I'm just get curious.
And I think that fits in well with at least one of the phrases that you use often in your book, shields down, information in. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's the result of everything I just said. So if you want shields to come down with people, just seek that non-judgmental curiosity, which again is one of those four pillars. Seek thoughts and opinions of others, talk in terms of their priorities, validate them without judging them, and that's what that is. That's that non-judgmental curiosity, and then empower them with choices. You do those four things, and every statement that you make and everything you write down, their brain is now releasing dopamine and endorphins in the short term. They got serotonin and oxytocin going in the long term, and their brain is saying that this person is valuing me and they're good for me, all because you're curious and you're using language that is focused on them and not yourself. And it is beautiful. I mean, think about this. Think about the strongest, healthiest relationship you have in your life. How often during your last conversation, engagement with that human being, did you actually seek their thoughts and opinions instead of sharing your own? Talk in terms of what's important to them instead of yourself. Validated them non-judgmentally with everything they're talking about. And if appropriate, you gave them choices. Anecdotally, we do this only 10 to 15% of the time, and those were the people we love the most. Can you imagine the power of building that trust and connection if you did it all the time? And as a matter of fact, we know people like this in our lives. These are the people that are doing this very, very well, the ones we're naturally gravitated to. We can't wait to see them. We can't wait to talk to them. Because I guarantee you, they're asking about you, they're talking things that are important to you, and they're not judging what's coming out of your mouth.
I also liked when you were talking about validating others. Can you also talk a little bit about what that means and how you can validate others without being condescending or obvious? Because again, that's going to stand out. What does it really mean to validate others?
So I like using law enforcement examples for this, just because there's some people that you deal with in law enforcement that can be unsavory type people. So how do you validate someone that is completely unsavory? Well, and actually, the world of ILF, there are some very unsavory people that are trafficking, and human, and children and child porn and all that. But at the same time, you're going to need to interact with these people at some point if you want to save more lives and understand what they're doing, how they're doing it. And if you want to understand that, I can guarantee you this: if you're going to sit across a table and judge their actions, or they're going to share with you. And what's the goal? I want to save more children. I want to take down your network. And if you're going to sit across a table and judge them, I can guarantee you they're not going to open up. Validation is more of the walk a mile in my shoes, understand my shoes, and seek to understand those things. The crazy thing about the world of counterintelligence, especially in the world of espionage, if someone's committing espionage, espionage is usually not the only thing going sideways in that person's life. Betraying your country is one indicator of many things that are psychologically challenging for that person. A lot of a good number of the espionage subjects, the true espionage subjects that we investigated, actually happened to be pedophiles as well. Sad, but true. And I remember we had a goal, and this is a dark story, and I apologize for the dark story, but it emphasizes your point of validation, the difference between validating and agreeing with someone. And our goal that we were given was this person was already arrested and awaiting sentencing. And we knew, because the person, I mean, we knew there was about 40 or 50 victims that were unidentified. And our goal that we were given was we had to get this person, who had to inspire this person to share the names of the victims so we could try to, help save these kids. And if you're going to, I guarantee you this, if you're sitting across from this 50-something-year-old individual who's already arrested for espionage and now is waiting sentencing on trafficking, child porn, and also child molestation, if you're going to sit across that table and judge, are they going to share and are you going to save children? No. So how do you not judge? Here's what it is. It's seeking to understand is critical. In this particular case, this gentleman had journaled, and he had journaled about these children he had abused. So that's why we knew there was more. But he talked about an amazing thing. He talked about love in his journals. Luckily for us, he also had a poem he had written about when he was 9 years old and he was sexually assaulted and raped by the Boy Scouts and the Cub Master. And he had been sexually abused by those Cub Masters from the age of 9 to 19. And so his definition of love that he had written about in this poem was when sex wasn't forced. Love, not love, was when sex was forced. So he had defined love, according to him and his upbringing, from his context as sex. And so in his context of his mind, He didn't force anyone. He was demonstrating his version of love. He was rationalizing it. It's creepy. It's horrible. It's horrendous. But that was his context. It's from his mind, he was providing psychological comfort to these children. That's his context. So when you're sitting across this individual, you can start having a conversation about, I understand you care very deeply about these children. Is that true? Yeah, I do care very deeply about these children. I said, would it be harmful, do you think, to them or to yourself to know that you actually did harm to them and they're damaged? Oh, it'd be horrible to know that. Well, what kind of behaviors you think are appropriate and inappropriate? You know, so these are the this is the way you have a conversation without agreeing, but understanding and demonstrating context. Remember, empathy doesn't mean you agree with someone. Empathy says you understand how that person sees the world from their context. And then that conversation then goes to, well, if you'd be willing to share the names of these individuals, we could probably go do some help and put things right by them. Is that something you might feel comfortable doing? That's how you have a conversation with someone you don't agree with and that you validate.
In your book, you also gave an example of the empathetic validation with the YouTube video of the nail in the head.
And it, yeah. Not it all shows, about the nail. Yeah.
Yes, where it shows examples of how to not do the validation and then finally does show it with the very probably common phrase that lots of people have heard, where I think the final phrase was, that sounds really difficult. And that seems to be good validation that people like to hear, that sounds difficult.
You know, I deal with this a lot with my own family and my own kids too. There are times when you listen to someone, there are times when people want to vent, which is basically they're looking for validation. They're just looking for a head nod. They're looking for a little comfort displays from you. They're looking for you to just validate what they're saying by saying, that sounds tough. That sounds like it was challenging. And there's other times when they're looking for you to be a resource for solving a challenge and a problem in their lives. You know, you have to really pay attention to the cues about what someone needs at a certain time and adjust yourself accordingly. If you like solving problems and that's all you keep like doing is when someone brings you a problem, you want to solve it and they stop talking to you or they start arguing with you, realize they weren't looking for you to solve a problem. They were venting their problem to you so they could actually, because some people think out loud, some people, you know, everyone's completely different on these things. Make sure you're giving people what they need and not what you want to give them.
And I think sometimes it's perfectly fine after giving the validation to ask, do you want me to help you solve this problem?
I do that a lot. You know, my son goes through challenges at the Naval Academy and, you know, sometimes, you know, he'll bring challenges up and I'll listen. And then I say, you know, I'll say, hey, are we looking to solve this or are we just or do we need to vent? Because again, what are you doing? You're seeking their thoughts and opinions. You're talking in terms of what's important to them and you're empowering them with choice about how to move forward. Again, those four pillars are critical for great communication.
They sure are. Another thing that I think can help social engineers, and there's a great illustration of it in Code of Trust, is the Ben Franklin effect, gift giving. And I remember there was one example with Jesse's trick that was mentioned in Code of Trust with a potential asset, Steve, where Jesse just thanked Steve for giving his time. Can you talk a little bit about the Ben Franklin effect and how that works?
Yeah, so the Ben Franklin effect is basically where you preemptively give a gift ahead of time for someone or thank them for a favor they've done because it makes them psychologically beholding and thinking from their point of view, there's a deeper relationship there than there might otherwise be. A lot of social engineers and others will use this, especially with enemies or people that are in a position where they think they don't have a relationship, and it creates great dividends. It goes, you know, whether you're offering in advance or whether you're doing it in reciprocity or something, there is nothing better than gift giving, either proactively or retroactively. And so, because again, it breaks down shields and barriers, and from the other person's point of view, it gives them the impression that there's a stronger relationship than they otherwise thought there was. So I love gift giving. I do it as often as I can. You know, if I read an author that I think is a fantastic author, I know that people are, especially really popular ones, won't answer emails or things like that. I will always reach out and make contact and not have an ask. I offer a thanks. And I say, I'd love to send you a signed copy of one of my books and thank you for putting out the great content you have in the world, because I've benefited greatly from it and I've shared it with as many people as I can. I just want to give you thanks. And you'd be amazed sometimes that the nice correspondence you get back. Sometimes you get silence, but more times than not, you get a very nice correspondence back with someone that otherwise probably wouldn't have talked to you.
And one of the things that I really liked about the way Jesse worked that was how the Ben Franklin effect often works well when the other person has given you a gift that they might then be more helpful in the future. And the person that you two were speaking with might not have had any idea that they had given you any kind of gift. And Jesse sort of put that on the person immediately just by thanking him for giving you the gift of his time, which seemed to fall right into that. And it seemed like a hope from Jesse that you'd be able to get additional things out of this person.
Yep, asking for a gift or asking for a borrow, because that's what I think Ben Franklin actually came up with, that as a friend of his or someone that he didn't have a great relationship wanted to have. Ben Franklin wanted to have a better relationship with him, so he asked him to borrow his favorite book. And so, you know, back then before television or anything, you know, book lending was it's a high thing, you know, because, you know, people treasured their books, they treasured their libraries, and he knew this individual I can't remember which book it was, but he cherished the book. And Ben Franklin literally asked him for that favor, to borrow that book. Didn't even read it, he said. He just borrowed it and held on to it for 2 weeks just because it put him in debt to him. And that, from that person's impression, they had a stronger relationship than otherwise would have had. So when you ask a favor, when you ask for a gift or thank someone for a gift of time, it's doing the same thing.
A lot of times when we hear of sales pitches, like even, for example, like a timeshare sales pitch, there's often food involved. Why is it a good idea to have these sorts of sales pitches that involve food?
There's a few reasons. You know, number one, for food, you know, again, if it's a favorite food, you know, it's going to release dopamine in the brain, especially if it's something you grew up with or something, you know, anything like that. It's just always going to release dopamine in the brain. And if you can associate that, you know, the good pleasure centers in a brain with the individual, that'll go a long way. I mean, in sizing people up, I talk about the gentleman Anan from a Middle Eastern country, and his favorite family tradition growing up with this Middle Eastern leader was Kashmiri tea. And so that had a profound, you know, impact on him. And they had always released, you know, you could tell it was a great memory for him. So at the next meeting I had with Anan, we found and created Kashmiri tea and shared it. Because again, you can get that good feeling and all the neurotransmitters going in the brain, and you can link it to you. That's a good thing. The other thing it gives you the ability to, if you're going to break bread with someone, it gives you time. Because, you know, there's a couple of relationship accelerators you can use. Matter of fact, Jack Schaefer, my good friend Joe Navarro, and I was on my team. He wrote the book The Like Switch, and he wrote just came out with The Truth Detector, which is a great complete book on elicitation. One of the things that he talks about is relationship accelerators and the way you can accelerate relationships. Granted, you got to watch the other person, because if you're accelerating it faster than their tempo is willing, you can really blow it. But one of them is proximity. Proximity, in other words, are you meeting in person, like to break bread, or are you meeting over Zoom, or is it a text? Proximity is an accelerator. And time is another accelerator. So more time is over a meal. And then what also time gives you is the other accelerator called intensity. Intensity is the depth and level of the conversation you're going to have with someone. If you're sharing a meal with someone, you can talk about the first time you had that meal, a tradition in which you have. I mean, it allows you to go back in time and have this individual recall positive events in their lives, which again releases the positive brain chemistry, which then is now linked to you. And now you can share anecdote and story, limitedly, of course, so you can keep the focus on them. So you start building overlapping context and content with each other, and that's where you start making connections. So connections are made where you have that commonality of priority, commonality of background. Matter of fact, I just did a great interview with Jack Barsky, which is a KGB defector. He wrote the book Deep Undercover, and what Jack talks about in his book is his upbringing in East Germany right after World War II, and he talks about his self-reliance and incredible fortitude he had to live on basically nothing. His family had nothing on, and all the way up to his hard studies he did and was recruited by the KGB finally. But I built commonality because I didn't have his upbringing, but I also had a tough upbringing too, where I had to go to work at a young age, made me incredibly self-reliant, which makes us tend to be a little more self-centered earlier in life because we think we can only rely on ourselves and no relationships. In other words, we built a connection, even though we didn't have the same upbringing, is a similar enough, similar in context that you can make that connection. I feel like I made a lifelong friend in Jack because you built that connection. And how? By seeking their thoughts and opinions and getting that way back intensity of conversation that can happen from breaking bread and sharing a meal.
I'm going to apologize for jumping all over the place here, but as I was reading the books, I was taking notes and I saw these little sections that I thought were super great and wanted to share with people. One of the other sections, things that you mentioned in there is the platinum rule, which is a little bit different from the golden rule. What makes the platinum rule better than the golden rule of treat others how that you want to be treated?
Yeah, so the platinum rule, matter of fact, the book it came from is right here. Well, you can't see it anyway, but it's called The Platinum Rule by Alessandra and O'Connor. And I first read that back in, I think it was around 2007. And it's a take on DISC, you know, the personality discernment inventory, but what it focuses on and what the DISC focuses on, all these personality assessments, is understanding others and how others want to be communicated with. So what the platinum rule is, instead of treating others as you'd be treated, which is fine, there's nothing wrong with the golden rule, it's fine because it's the intent is phenomenally good and altruistic. But the challenge is that if you're going to treat people how you want to be treated, what if people don't want to be treated like you? You know, so what the platinum rule is, understanding how others want to be treated and then treating them according to that. And so when you do things like understanding the platinum rule, so for an example, if someone tends to be more people oriented than task oriented, when I'm paying attention to them and I'm a people oriented person, that means I communicate through a lot of anecdotes, stories, and use of pronouns, and I share, and out of 30 minutes of conversation, you might get one or two actionable items. That's how someone people-oriented generally talks. Now, if I'm talking to someone who's task-oriented, I am driving them completely up a wall because they just want the two items. So I'm treating them exactly how I want to be treated, but what you're doing is you're really pissing them off. As opposed to if I recognize right from the get-go that this person is task-oriented and they just want to cut to the chase a little bit. Again, it has nothing to do with, you know, being mean or cruel or just, that's just how they prefer to communicate. So I should lose my anecdotes and stories. I should get more to the point so I can accommodate them and how they prefer to interact.
I think this will be the last question that I ask you for social engineers or about social engineering. One thing that you suggest is when you're nervous that you might start speaking a little bit fast and that's going to turn people off. So what advice did you give people who are nervous to be able to slow down their rate of speech?
Yeah, and I suck at this because I'm from the Northeast as an expert. I talk and everyone knows that listens to me ever anywhere. I give you what I call death by Robin. I can go and go and go and go. But it's generally will have a negative impact if you're overselling, because that's what it sounds like. So you do need to slow it down. Matching the demographic and the tempo from the other individual is really key and critical, because again, it shows that you're accommodating. Again, as part of the platinum rule, speak at a tempo in which they want to talk and discuss. But the way in which to do that, for me, I really got to go through and ask myself, before I open this mouth of mine, is what I'm about to say or do going to do one? Is it going to help or hinder creating a good, healthy relationship? That makes me slow down. Is this going to help or not? And two, is what I'm about to say or do going to include at least one of those four things? Am I going to be seeking the thought and opinion? Am I going to be talking in terms of a priority of theirs? Am I going to be validating them in some way? And am I going to be given a choice in some way? So always think about the content about what I'm about to say. Can I phrase it in a way that's going to have one of those four things in it? That slows me down.
Why are you a board member of the Innocent Lives Foundation, and why is the Innocent Lives Foundation important to you?
That's a fun, easy one. Chris and I have been friends for a long time, and about a year before I retired is when he had dreamed of ILF because of the work he was doing, and he was stumbling across some really bad actors out there, and he said, I need to do something about this. And I remember he chatted with me about it and about how to, you know, kind of link, you know, and make our work worthwhile by dealing with law enforcement. And so my role became kind of a communication translator, you know, between, you know, individuals that have never worked with law enforcement or federal law enforcement before, and understanding how, you know, federal law enforcement operates and works, so you can help manage the expectations of the ILF. And when I retired, he immediately asked me to join the board, and all in, absolutely, because there's a few things I like that I enjoy out of it. One is the translation portion, you know, to bring that link between the two. And we have a great, great, healthy relationship with law enforcement now, you know, for whoever, you know, for turning our cases over. So for uncovering these folks. And the other part too is, you know, I'm all about trust and healthy relationships and building those healthy relationships. I love the preventative stuff we can do. I love, you know, if we can teach parents how to have those conversations and relationships with our children to prevent these things from happening before the grooming takes place, or even recognizing the grooming when it starts happening, we can keep our children safe before it gets too late. And if it is too late, at least have them want to come to us, and know that there is no shame in people taking advantage of you. It's not your fault. And so those are the things I like to do, and my add-in for the ILF.
And I think on one of the recent social engineer podcasts, you might have talked a little bit about the training that you're planning to offer at next year's Human Hacker Conference. Is that something that you're willing to talk about a little bit more?
Absolutely. Matter of fact, as a insight, I literally have the schedules right in front of me right here. And I'm actually having a talk with my literary agent today, because we might have another book deal coming out. We'll see. So what I'm offering and what I'm going to do at a Human Hacking Conference is what I'm calling the Spy Recruitment Bootcamp. Spy Recruitment Bootcamp, and it's going to be Interpersonal Communication Tradecraft. So basically what I'm doing is I'm going to be walking everyone through that takes the course. I think we're going to have it at 4 hours. It's going to be a lot of information kind of rapidly coming at you. We're going to walk you through an entire case of recruiting a spy. One of my cases I worked, and matter of fact, I have the scenario right here that I used to teach. And we're going to walk through what's a spy, how do you identify a spy, and right through the recruitment process of spot, assess, develop, recruit, and handle. And in each one of those processes, I'm going to cover techniques for that process, which is going to be including rapport, trust, make a connection, elicitation, as well as then applications to leadership and business. So it's going to be, here's a spy recruitment life, here's applications to life and business. So I'm actually going to be walking everyone through one of my cases where, hey, here's the information I was provided. Here's some background. What do you do? Here's what I did. All right, next step. So it's going to be a lot of fun where we're actually going to be walking through a spy recruitment case.
That sounds awesome. I can't wait to see that. You also offer training and you have your books available. How can people find out more information about your training and your books?
Yeah, everything, as I call Death by Robin, is on peopleformula.com. All one word, peopleformula.com. It's all scalable. So if you're looking for free resources, I list all these podcasts like this on the site under podcasts and videos. I have my own YouTube channel where I post videos, as well as my interviews of authors that are willing to come on and chat with me. And I have my online training academy, and that's the big thing you can do on your own as well. I have a training block for each one of my books, as well as an advanced training block for each one of my books. And the advanced training block does come with an hour coaching session with me, and you can bundle it together. I also have an Insider to Threat course on there as well. And you can, you can have me come speak for your organization. And also the thing that's also on there, I have a bookstore. In my bookstore, obviously, are my three books you can buy, but also they're all the books I have read this year in 2021 on there as well, because I do social posts on the books I read. And that's also on there on the Daily Thoughts one. But yeah, so all the books I read that impact me and how I'm learning and growing are also available. So you can kind of track the progress together if you want to.
Robin Drake, this has been so much fun. I wanted to say thank you for joining the Layer 8 podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thank you on the Layer 8 podcast. It was a great fun time as well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Layer 8 podcast. You can find out more information about us at layer8conference.com and find more podcast episodes on many of your favorite platforms. We hope you enjoy these episodes as much as we enjoyed making them.